proclaiming the gospel to the Jew first and also to the Greek. Shalom and welcome to the Everlasting Nation Broadcast, a radio ministry of International Board of Jewish Missions. I'm your host, Aaron Broughton. I want to thank you for joining us on today's program. Perhaps no other time in recent history has captured our attention as the Holocaust during World War II. As we remember over 6 million Jews that were killed by the Nazi regime, we must not forget. I think it is tragic that many are forgetting these horrors today, and we must keep the memories of the dead and the living foremost in our minds. One of the biggest questions concerning the Holocaust is, where was God in all of this? Even though this is not an easy question to answer, we should take comfort in the justice of God. As the war came to an end and the Allies defeated the Axis powers, many Nazi war criminals were captured and put on trial for their crimes. Some, however, escaped and became fugitives of justice. As we look at the next couple programs that we'll have, we'll actually look at the efforts of one man who tracked down and captured several of the Nazi fugitives. This man, himself a survivor of Nazi concentration camps, became perhaps the most famous Nazi hunter. So we begin with a look at the life of Simon Wiesenthal. Simon Wiesenthal was born in 1908 in what is now Western Ukraine. It is interesting to note that Simon Wiesenthal's father, Asher, was a wholesaler by trade who immigrated to Austro-Hungarian Empire from Russia due to the harsh pogroms against the Jews there. Simon's father served in the Austro-Hungarian army in World War I and died in combat in 1915. His mother and brother then moved to Vienna until the war was over. After his studies and marriage to Sila Müller in 1936, the Jewish people started facing persecution. Eventually, a ghetto was built in Lvov, which is near where they lived. Simon's mother, as well as 88 other family members, were killed in the Holocaust. Wiesenthal was eventually captured and spent years in several concentration camps, eventually ending in Mauthausen, which was liberated by the American Army in 1945. By this time, Simon Wiesenthal could barely walk, weighing only about 90 pounds. In spite of his condition, within weeks of being liberated, Simon Wiesenthal had compiled a list of 100 names of suspected Nazi war criminals to the American Counterintelligence Corps. This list consisted mostly of guards, camp commandants, and members of the Gestapo. Little did he know that this was the first step into his future work of hunting some of the most infamous Nazi war criminals. He would go around to the displaced persons camp and post pictures of several Nazis, collecting information by witnesses for the Americans to capture and identify the perpetrators of the Holocaust. These efforts came together in 1947 as Wiesenthal and 30 other volunteers founded the Jewish Historical Documentation Center in order to gather valuable information for future war crime trials. As the 1950s came, the Soviets and the West became more at odds with one another, which led eventually to the Cold War. With that, the pursuit of Nazi fugitives was not much of a priority. However, many remained at large. Simon Wiesenthal understood that he was not to receive much help and that most of his work was now on his own shoulders. Even though the world was already starting to forget the horrors of the Holocaust, Simon Wiesenthal was determined to keep the memory alive. But what drove him to this? He was quoted in an interview with Alan Levy saying, "When the Germans first came to my city, half of the population was Jewish, 150,000 Jews. When the Germans were gone, 500 were alive. Many times I was thinking that everything in life has a price, so to stay alive must also have a price. And my price was always that, if I lived, I must be a deputy for many people who are not alive." As we think of what happened with Simon Wiesenthal in his life as he pursued justice in capturing Nazi war criminals, even so, I believe that we need to be always mindful of these horrors of the Holocaust and also pray to God that He would give comfort and grace even during these times. One way that IBJAM is doing that is actually through our annual Holocaust Education Day. In fact, March 20th of 2015, here at our mission headquarters, IBJAM in Hickson, Tennessee, the greater Chattanooga area, we'll be having this seminar. I invite you to contact us concerning that. Now, with this in mind, let's now turn to our good friend and Bible teacher, Brother Mark Oshman, with today's Bible message.
Welcome back to our daily broadcast. We will continue our study of the Jewish tabernacle and the items contained inside it. The Hebrew noun Mishkan, translated as tabernacle, The Hebrew noun mishkan derived from the verb shakan, meaning to abide. That verb appeared in the 24th chapter of Numbers, in connection with the Israelites residing in their tents. A mishkan could refer to an animal's den, as it did in the 39th chapter of Job. God said to Job of an animal, quote, "whose house I have made the wilderness, and the barren land his dwellings," unquote. The word mishkan could also allude to a human residence. Most of the time, though, it specifically designated the tabernacle. God planned the tabernacle to be a place where he could dwell in the midst of the Israelite encampment, as recorded in the 25th chapter of Exodus. On that occasion, he told Moses, quote, "Let them make me a sanctuary, that I may dwell among them, according to all that I show thee after the pattern of the tabernacle, and the pattern of all the instruments thereof, even so shall ye make it," unquote. God never intended for the tabernacle to depict his residence on earth. In 1 Kings chapter 8, Solomon rhetorically asks, quote, "Will God indeed dwell on the earth?" unquote. That monarch answered his own question, noting that, quote, "Behold, the heaven and heaven of heavens cannot contain thee," unquote. As a spirit, God did not need a building to live in. The tabernacle made it possible for God to manifest his presence among the Jewish people, in a manner of speaking. The extent of detail that God provided about the tabernacle's material and about its contents indicated the importance of that structure in the spiritual life of the Jewish nation. God wanted the Jews to appreciate their unique relationship with him whenever they visited the tabernacle. In the 12th chapter of Deuteronomy, God gave the Jewish people one reason why he commanded them to build the tabernacle. On that occasion, he said, quote, "Take heed to thyself that thou offer not thy burnt offerings in every place that thou seest, but in the place which the Lord shall choose in one of thy tribes, there thou shalt offer thy burnt offerings, and there thou shalt do all that I command thee," unquote. Even hundreds of years later, according to 1 Samuel chapter 1, Elkanah and his family brought their sacrifices to the tabernacle. That practice implied God continued to utilize the tabernacle as a meeting place, even after the Israelites left the wilderness. According to Joshua chapter 18, the Jews set up the tabernacle at Shiloh, where they subdivided the land of Canaan among the tribes. The tabernacle remained at the city of Shiloh until Solomon had the temple constructed. Afterwards, that monarch brought the Ark of the Covenant up to Jerusalem, an event noted in 1 Kings chapter 8. Looking at the furniture of the tabernacle, two altars existed, the brazen altar and the altar of incense. The brazen altar consisted of wood, overlaid with brass, which was possibly bronze or copper, alloyed with tin. By contrast, the altar of incense consisted of wood, overlaid by gold. The two altars served different purposes in the tabernacle. In the 20th chapter of Exodus, God originally directed Moses to construct an earthen altar in order to sacrifice the Jewish people's burnt offerings. In that, he gave these instructions to Moses, quote, "And if thou wilt make me an altar of stone, thou shalt not build it of hewn stone. For if thou lift up thy tool upon it, thou hast polluted it. Neither shalt thou go up by steps unto mine altar, that thy nakedness be not discovered thereon," unquote. Furthermore, those found guilty of shedding blood could flee to the altar and grasp its horn in order to beg for mercy. This had its qualifications, though. According to Exodus chapter 21, quote, "If a man come presumptuously upon his neighbor to slay him with guile, thou shalt take him from mine altar, that he may die," unquote. In Exodus chapter 27, God instructed Moses about how the Jews should fashion the brazen altar, also known as the altar of the burnt offering. The brazen altar had dimensions of 5 cubits in length, 5 cubits in breadth, and 3 cubits in height. That is, 7.5 feet tall, 7.5 feet wide, and 4.5 feet high. Horns, which were projections, were made from wood and overlaid with brass, and put upon each corner of the brazen altar. These horns functioned as more than mere ornamentation, though. The Israelite priests bound sacrifices to these horns. In addition, as mentioned above, fugitives seeking mercy could flee to this altar and grasp its horns. In Jewish history, Adonijah and Joab did in the opening chapters of 1 Kings. They fled to the altar and grasped its horns as a plea for mercy from the then King Solomon. An interesting application of this practice appeared in Psalm 118. That particular chapter comprised one of the Hallel, or praise psalms. These were songs sung by the Jewish people around the Passover table. The author of Psalm 118 wrote these words, quote, "Bind the sacrifice with cords, even unto the horns of the altar," unquote. At the Last Supper, Jesus Christ and his disciples may have chanted those words in anticipation of the Savior's coming atonement. An item known as a, quote, "grate of network of brass," unquote, lay inside a hollowed-out portion of the brazen altar to hold the sacrifices in place. This grate had four brazen rings on each corner. It may have resembled a sieve, in order that the sacrificial fires below might more thoroughly consume the offerings given. God directed Moses to construct, quote, "pans to receive his ashes, and his shovels, and his basins, and his flesh hooks, and his fire pans," unquote. Every utensil was covered with brass. The purpose of those items involved dispersing that which remained from the burnt offerings. The brazen altar symbolized the judgment that the Savior experienced on the cross when he bore upon himself the sins of the world. In that sense, Jesus Christ was a type of that bronze serpent that God commanded Moses to make in Numbers chapter 21. A brazen serpent to help counteract the plague and the effects of the plague God sent on the Israelites. Likewise, Zechariah chapter 6 provided an example of this imagery. When the prophet saw four horses coming from between what he termed, quote, "mountains of brass," unquote, the riders of these horses came to execute God's decrees against the inhabitants of the earth. Furthermore, the animals killed on the brazen altar typified Jesus Christ as God's acceptable sacrifice. In the fifth chapter of Ephesians, Paul compared the sacrificial death of Jesus Christ to an offering made unto God. The writer of Hebrews likewise penned words about that in the 13th chapter of his epistle. Quote, "We have an altar whereof they have no right to eat, which serve the tabernacle," unquote. Turning now to the altar of incense, the Old Testament referred to the altar of incense by other names such as, quote, "the golden altar," unquote, or, quote, "the altar of gold," unquote. According to the 30th chapter of Exodus, the altar of incense measured 1 cubit long, 1 cubit wide, 2 cubits high, 1.5 feet tall, 1.5 feet wide, and 3 feet high. As with the brazen altar, the altar of incense had four horns, one on each corner. It also had rings on its sides in order that the Levites could transport it by inserting gold-plated sticks into those rings and carrying the altar on their shoulders. According to the 30th chapter of Exodus, the high priest offered incense twice a day, during the morning sacrifice and during the evening sacrifice. Once a year on the Day of Atonement, the high priest needed to place the blood of the sin offering upon the horns of the golden altar. The altar of incense typified the prayer of God's saints. In Psalm 141, the author equated his petitions with incense offered to God. Revelation chapter 8 also referred to the burning of incense and connected it with the prayers of God's saints. God told Moses in Exodus chapter 40, quote, "Thou shalt set the altar of gold for the incense before the ark of the testimony," unquote. The placement of the altar of incense immediately before the veil symbolized the connection between prayer made unto God and the mercy which flowed from God. Both the brazen altar and the altar of incense played important roles in the Jewish sacrificial system. Sin had separated the Jewish people from their God. By means of God's judgment against sin, as typified by the brazen altar, the Jewish people could approach God in prayer, as represented by the golden offering. This concludes our current lesson. We invite you to please come back for our final session about the tabernacle and its contents.
You've been listening to the Everlasting Nation broadcast, a radio ministry of International Board of Jewish Missions. For more information, you can write us at P.O. Box 1386, Hickson, Tennessee 37343, or call us at 423-876-8150, or you may also go online at ibjm.org. Until next time, may God bless and shalom.